From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, The Right Stuff, we meet General Chuck Yeager, the first man to fly faster than the speed of sound. A generation later, Yeager still tests jet fighters. We also meet Carol Leifer, a comedian who's trying to become the perfect woman of the 80s, but failing. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles singer Rufus Thomas, the man Ed says put Memphis on the map, and book critic John Leonard reviews Joseph Heller's new novel, Picture This. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Tom Wolfe called my guest, General Chuck Yeager, the most righteous of all the possessors of the right stuff. Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff, was the story of why military men were willing, even delighted, to fly high-performance aircraft against astonishingly deadly odds. Chuck Yeager was a fighter pilot in World War II. After surviving many dogfights, he took another risky job, testing high-performance aircraft. He rapidly earned the reputation of America's top test pilot. And he was the first pilot to fly faster than the speed of sound. He made that historic flight October 14, 1947, in an X-1 aircraft, which he rode 40,000 feet high, traveling over 660 miles per hour. In 1953, he established a world speed record of 1,650 miles per hour in an X-1A rocket plane. During his long Air Force career, Yeager served as Assistant Chief of Test Flight Operations at Edwards Air Force Base, commanded the Airspace Research Pilot School, and oversaw five squadrons of combat aircraft in Vietnam. He retired from the Air Force in 1975. 10 years later, he became the author of a best-selling autobiography. He's just completed a follow-up memoir called Press On, Further Adventures in the Good Life. Lots of Americans read about Yeager's adventures in his autobiography and in The Right Stuff. Now his TV commercials have made his face almost as recognizable as his name.
One thing that I think you probably don't remember, I was on the cover of Time magazine in 48 and on the cover of Newsweek in 54, and hardly a month went by in the old days that some major publication didn't do a story about me. But you're right, what happened, they knew the name, but then when I started doing the AC Delco commercials, they associated my face with the name, and that really exploded it.
You know, Tom Wolfe implies in his book, The Right Stuff, that you have the prototypical pilot's voice, the voice that became the prototypical pilot's voice that you'll hear reassuring you when you're taking off in an airplane.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I don't think so. Obviously came from West Virginia, and I always had a drawl. And I have a distinctive voice on the radio, and it made a good story, and there may be some truth to it. I'm not one to confirm or deny it.
Let's talk about actually breaking the sound barrier. Did you have any idea what the heck the sound barrier was when you took on the mission of trying to break it?
Well, I knew the laws of nature, that sound travels at some 760 miles an hour at sea level and some 660 miles an hour at 35,000 feet and higher. I also knew we had buffeting problems because of shock waves, because I experienced those in air combat, you know, in World War II when I was flying Mustangs over Germany. I also experienced it in the early jets, the P-80s and P-84s. I knew exactly what the problem was.
So what image did you have in your mind about breaking the sound barrier? For civilians like us, you almost see this invisible shield or a wall that somebody will be penetrating as they break it.
Yeah, I didn't, give any thought to you, to tell you the truth, Terry, because I was pretty well duty-oriented at that time. I'd been in a war where, a lot of guys get killed, but I'd learned to discipline myself to concentrate on what you're doing and forget about the outcome, because you can't do an awful lot about it anyway. So when we started the X-1 program, I had no idea what I would run into, but the point is, I could care less, to tell you the truth. I just had to press on with my mission. So,
was there a worst case scenario in either your mind or the mind of the people who were commanding the mission? But what might happen the first time a plane broke the sound barrier?
We didn't have any idea because, see, we're fooling around with an unknown factor, and we didn't have any wind tunnel data, obviously, in the region of the speed of sound. and no other airplane had ever been there, so we didn't really know. And about half of the engineers, as I recall, in talking to them, didn't give us much chance of succeeding. And the other half were, you know, said, well, you might and you might not. But the point is, when I started, the outcome really didn't make any difference at all whether or not I pressed on with the mission, because it was my duty to do it, and I was probably the most qualified guy to do it.
Now, the head of the mission wanted to hire, as the first pilot to break the sound barrier, a single man because of the possible dangers. And I was wondering how you felt about your wife, about the risk for her, knowing how dangerous everyone thought this mission might be.
Well, flying combat's dangerous, too. But
true.
I participated in that. And then when I came home and got married, we have to go back. Glennis and I had a very good understanding, and you'll see it come out. You saw it come out in my autobiography and also the new book, The Press On. But I was flying when I married her, and she always would make that statement, well, you know, whatever you do is okay with me. And that was our attitude, and she was a great supporter for me getting involved in research flying, because I was really duty-oriented. And since it was my job, and she realized it, and that's what I wanted to do, and she went right along with it. So.
General Chuck Yeager is my guest, the test pilot who first broke the sound barrier, and he has a sequel to his autobiography. It's now called Press On, Further Adventures in the Good Life. The plane that you broke the sound barrier in, the X-1, had a nose cone that was designed like a bullet. How come?
Yeah, because they knew that bullets flew faster than sound, and the ogive, or shape of the fuselage of the X-1, was shaped like a 50-caliber bullet, and that's just common sense because, like I say, we're flying in the area of unknowns.
Was it comfortable where you'd have to sit in the?
Well, no, it was very uncomfortable, and the reason was we had no source of power in the X-1. We used compressed nitrogen gas to do all the work, like raise and lower the gear and pressurize the liquid oxygen tanks, which, incidentally, they had no seat in the X-1. You sat with your back against the bulkhead, which contained the liquid oxygen, and the temperature of the liquid oxygen was 290 degrees below zero, and it was one of the coldest cockpits I've ever been in my life. And you sat on the floor, and your knees were higher than your rear end, so you could pull high Gs without blacking out, and you couldn't see too well out of it. But you got to remember, it was a research airplane, and it was built in 1944, so.
It really does sound very uncomfortable from the way you're
well,
describing it.
Well, it was, but, you know, you sat in the thing almost an hour, but it kept you awake, that's for sure.
Right. Well, when you were flying it, what indications would you have, what kind of meters would tell you when you had actually broken the sound barrier?
Well, I had an altimeter that told me how high I was. I had an indicated airspeed and that told me how fast I was going through the air in miles per hour. But the one thing that we relied on was a Mach meter, that told us what our percentage was in relationship to the speed of sound. For instance, Mach 1 is the speed of sound at the altitude you're flying. And if you're going 0.9 Mach, that's 90% of the speed of sound. Because, see, an airplane responds to the effects of the speed of sound, like or shock waves on the airplane. So you're only interested in your percentage of the speed of sound or the Mach number that you're going. I had a Mach meter that went up to 1.0. And the day that I actually broke Mach 1, I sat there and watched that Mach meter build up, you know, since we'd been up to about 0.94 or 0.95 Mach number on the previous flight. And I watched it build up, and when it got up to about 0.96, and then the buffeting was quite heavy on the airplane, it was shaking pretty bad. But then at that point, the Mach meter went off the scale, and if I extrapolated, you know, it'd be about 1.06, but the Mach meter only went to 1.0. But when it did, all the buffeting smoothed out, which was an indication that we had, you know, supersonic flow over the whole airplane, meaning that it was flying at supersonic speeds. And when this happened, we made the first sonic boom there at Edwards, and that's about the way it happened.
Could you hear the sonic boom from the plane?
No, you're in the airplane, which is in a pressurized cockpit, and guys, you've got a helmet on, an oxygen mask, and no, you're making the shockwave. It's on your airplane, and you don't hear a shockwave or sonic boom.
After you've reached or broken into, whichever the expression is, Mach 1, when you're re-entering a slower speed.
Backing up through Mach 1, you get the same characteristics that you got going through, except backwards.
Wow. When you realized that you'd broken the speed of sound, that your mission was accomplished. Did you stay up in the air a while and just have a good time and celebrate?
I didn't have... No, you can't stay up because, see, a rocket, you burn out all of your fuel. It only had to last 2.5 minutes, and then you're gliding down to make a dead stick landing on Rogers Dry Lake out there at Edwards, or then Muroc Air Base. I was elated. I did a couple rolls, and when I got down, since I was pretty well beat up from a horseback riding accident a couple days before, I was kind of bushed. And also, you're sitting in that cold airplane. You really get cold soaked, and it's good to get out into the warm sun. And also, their program was classified, so it's not exactly as the film The Right Stuff depicts it. But we knew it was classified, and just a couple, three of us had a little party that night. I mean, big party, if you want to call it that.
Well, because it was classified, you even had to speak in code in your radio communications while you were in flight.
Ridley and I knew what we were doing, and, you know, you really don't say a heck of a lot anyway when you're flying.
What were the reasons for classifying it? Why was it so top secret?
Because of what we found out. And the reason was, if you recall, once we got into the region of the speed of sound, we lost our elevator effectiveness. Now, Terry, this may get a little technical, but all airplanes, light airplanes, if you looked at them, they have a horizontal stabilizer or a tail, and on the trailing edge of that horizontal stabilizer and the elevators or flippers. And when you move the control stick back, that elevator goes up. And that's what controls the attitude of your airplane. It makes the nose go up or go down. And when we got up to about 0.93 Mach number, or 93% of the speed of sound, we lost the effectiveness of that elevator on the X-1. And we couldn't control our airplane. But we had built a capability into the X-1 of moving the whole horizontal stabilizer or tailplane. And we found out that lo and behold, we could control the X-1 through Mach 1 with that horizontal stabilizer. Now, it was interesting to me, when that happened, we found that out. Then, of course, we started building flying tails on our airplanes, that our combat airplanes that were built 3 or 4 years later. And it was amusing to me to find out that the British and the French and the Soviet Union didn't find out that little trick for 5 years. That was the reason it was classified, and mm-hmm. rightly so.
Chuck Yeager is my guest, and he's written a new memoir titled Press On, Further Adventures in the Good Life. How else did breaking the sound barrier change aviation?
Well, it opened up space to us. Up until that time, you recall, we would never had an airplane out beyond the speed of sound, and we didn't know what problems we would run into, and that flying tail that I mentioned is one of the secrets we found out that solved a lot of problems. We also developed higher thrust engines that could drive fighter aircraft or operational aircraft through the speed of sound. Once we got beyond the speed of sound, then there's no other barriers other than heat, and that opened up space for us.
Now, this is a very exciting time when you were flying these test missions. You had a few close calls, though, when you were flying the X-1 and the X-1A. There was one time, I think it was in the X-1A, which was the follow-up plane to the X-1, where you had gotten too high.
Well,
and,
too fast, Terry. See, in those days, back in the late 40s, early 50s, we were a lot of milestones to be broken, and we were moving out in speed. We'd broken Mach 1 in 1947, and 1953 rolled up, and we were working up above Mach 2, and we were just trying to go faster and faster to open up the universe. And the X-1A, I only made 4 flights in it, but on that particular flight, I'm setting at some, 80,000 feet, going 2.5 Mach number, or 2.5 times the speed of sound, or around 1,600 miles an hour. And we found out during that flight that the tail was not big enough on the X-1 to stabilize it, like the vertical stabilizer and the horizontal stabilizer didn't keep the airplane going straight ahead when we got out beyond 2.3 Mach number, and the airplane just swapped ends and went through some wild gyrations. And back in those days, we didn't have ejection seats, and you were pretty well locked into the airplane and couldn't get out, so you have to ride it down. And I was a little apprehensive about where I was going to hit in the high Sierras out there, but fortunately I stayed with the airplane and had enough instinct to recover from an inverted spin and then pop it out of the normal spin and find Rogers Dry Lake and come back and land. And I tell you, it was a wild ride, but the way I look at it, you either do or you don't. And, if you don't, you live happily ever after, so.
Well, you describe what it's like to see the ground coming up at you at 1,000 feet per second. That's a pretty dramatic image. How do you react? I mean, how can you think clearly
under
the circumstances when you're just like seconds away from actually meeting the Earth?
That's, you don't think, as I mentioned here a few minutes back in the broadcast, you really don't think about the outcome of anything. You concentrate on survival at the time, and you do everything you can to save your tail. And that's what I was doing, trying to fight the airplane to recover it from the spins. And my pressure suit was inflated. I was pretty well beat up because of high G loads and rattling around in the airplane. And no, I didn't pay any attention to the ground because, you know, it's nothing to do about hitting it anyway.
Well, I want to talk with you more about flying, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is General Chuck Yeager, who's written a follow-up to his best-selling autobiography. The new book is titled Press On, Further Adventures in the Good Life. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Chuck Yeager is my guest, the celebrated test pilot who first broke the sound barrier. Now, I learned from reading your books that you and most other pilots don't like to use the word crash. You have some other substitute expressions you prefer to use. Why won't you use the word crash, and what do you like better?
I don't know. That's just a word we didn't use because no one else used it. And, you know, auger in or bust your tail or things like that. So I think a little more expressive.
Was it a question of expressiveness or superstition?
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of expression, you know. I think it's something like busting your tail or augering in is a little more, got a little more sensationalism in it.
Yeah, or buying the farm.
Yeah, buying a farm or anything like that. It's crash, it's just probably too common and people don't say words like that.
Okay. You say that you've seen a lot of pilots get killed because of arrogance on their own part.
Well, basically, it's having the patience to learn the systems in an airplane. And when a guy, gets an arrogant attitude towards an airplane, chances are the thing will bite him because he hasn't taken enough time to learn about all of the systems. And being arrogant and complacent are two things that will kill you real quick in an airplane.
When we left off before the break, you were basically hurtling to the ground in the middle of a crash landing. How did you finally land that plane?
Not in the middle of a crash landing. I didn't crash. I was flying the X-1A, and when I recovered from the inverted spin at 25,000 feet, I looked around and dead-sticked it in, as I had all rockets like the X-1 and the X-1A at Rogers Dry Lake there at Edwards. So.
Now, you say that some pilots end up crashing because they take too long to decide whether to jump or land when the plane has gotten out of control?
Well, accidents in aircraft, there's human error involved in accidents about 75% of the time. Now, this could be pilot error or maintenance error or design or something. Anyway, human element enters into it. And in the early days when we started flying jet aircraft and we put ejection seats in them, then when a pilot gets himself, he always tries to save an airplane. And that was one of the transitions. When we first put ejection seats in our fighters, that gave us the capability of saving the pilot, but you lost the airplane. Now, one thing that a pilot hates to do is to leave an airplane because he tries to save it. And the way you save a crippled airplane is by dead-sticking it or a flame-out landing, meaning try to get the airplane on a road or an airplane when you haven't got any power. In order to do this, you have to be very good, number one, and number two, you've got to have a very good surface to land it on. And most pilots will try to get the airplane down on a runway, but since they don't have any power, they may screw up their pattern or miscalculate on their pattern. Then at the last minute, see, well, I can't possibly get this airplane down safely. I'll eject, but by then they're too low for their egress equipment to work, or the parachute or the ejection seat. So you lose your pilot and your airplane. So we went through a period of time back in the 50s when we had to really discipline pilots. If you lose your engine on this airplane, you eject, period. And don't fool around with trying to get it down in a dead stick landing.
How many times did you have to eject?
I bailed out of three airplanes. I lost had a P-39, and while in training back in 43, it blew up on me. And I also got shot down in a Mustang, and I bailed out of that one. And then I ejected out of the NF-104, which had a rocket seat in it, and I had a pressure suit on, and that was in, I think, 63.
Were you careful to get right back in a plane afterwards so that you wouldn't have time to get scared and lose your courage?
I've never had that problem. You know, flying is something just like driving a car, and even after I bailed out, or other than injuries, after you heal up a little bit, then it's no problem to get back into an airplane because that's your job, and I didn't have any kind of troubles like that.
You obviously really love flying. What's an example of why you love it so much? What's like your most heavenly experience up in the skies in a plane?
Terry, I'm not, you know, you've got a good way with words. Me flying an airplane is a job, and it's a way I make my living. And yes, I enjoyed flying because I was quite good at it. And anyone who is good at a job enjoys it. They should anyway. And I enjoy flying today because of the new technology. Just like, if you're a housewife in a kitchen and, man, you've been used to these old iron pans, somebody gives you a nice light Teflon-coated aluminum fry pan, you're happier than heck. Or if you give you a microwave oven, you have a lot of fun with it. Hey, I do the same thing with airplanes. The new technology makes it more fun to fly them.
Let me put it this way. I like my work a lot, but you wouldn't see me risking my life to do this radio show every day.
You don't see me out washing dishes either, do you?
Okay. You trained a lot of men who became astronauts. Do you regret that you missed the period where you could have become an astronaut yourself and gone off into space?
Well, I didn't miss the period. Actually, I was prime for the space program, which started in 1959. The only problem was, in order to apply for the space program or the first Mercury astronauts, you had to have a degree. And I didn't. I had a high school education, so I wasn't qualified and I didn't apply. Had I been qualified, I probably would have applied. But I didn't because I wasn't. But I was perfectly happy with doing the research flying that I'd been doing in the X-1, the X-1A, and the other aircraft there at Edwards. It'd be fun to fly an airplane like the shuttle. I wouldn't particularly care about riding in a capsule like the Mercury, Gemini, or the Apollo capsule back in the old days. But the shuttle, that's a different story. It'd be fun to fly. But on the other hand, it'd be a waste of money to train me.
Why?
Well, I'm too old. You wouldn't get a lot of longevity out of me, see?
Okay. Now, you started off your flying career in the military. You started as a truck mechanic, and mechanics is what led you into the military in the first place. How did you get from a mechanic to a flyer?
Well, you're right, my dad trained me as a mechanic, and I worked on all of his machinery. And then when I enlisted in the Air Force in 1941, straight out of high school, and America was mobilizing, so that was the thing that guys did. I was working on aircraft, and I was a crew chief. I noticed pilots had a little more fun than us maintenance types did, and lo and behold, in fact, in the 1st of December 1941, before the war started, before we got in the war, there was a bulletin on the bulletin board. I noticed a paper up there said, hey, if you're 18 years of age and have a high school education, you can apply for pilot training. You won't be commissioned a second lieutenant, because you'll be made a sergeant pilot. And I looked at that, and I said, hey, I'm 18. I have a high school education. So I applied for it, took my physical, and they called me up in the summer of 42, and I started flying, and then I started enjoying it. And, you know, it's just right place to right time, Terry.
When you were in the Air Force during World War II, you were shot down over France. My understanding is that you fought to get back into active duty after you were shot down.
Yes, and the reason was I got shot down on my eighth mission on March the 5th, 1944, And I'd flown eight missions. I'd shot down one airplane in combat. And when I evaded through occupied France and was interned in Spain after going through the Pyrenees, then they flew me back to England from Gibraltar. And I knew if I came home, I'd come home with flight officer, I'd be a flight officer the rest of my life. And I had felt I hadn't done my duty over there. And so I started resisting going home. And I worked my way up and got to meet General Eisenhower. And finally, if you remember, the reason they didn't want me to go back on combat is I was familiar with the underground, the Maquis or Free Frenchmen. And if you got shot down again, the Germans would probably sweat it out of you and you'd be a lot of innocent people killed. But fortunately, when I was in the middle of my resisting, the invasion started. The Maquis all surfaced and were fighting as an open army. And so that let the old man, or General Eisenhower, send me back to my squadron. So I went back on combat.
Before you became a test pilot, did you ever worry that you'd end up flying commercial airlines?
No, I don't give an awful lot of thought in career planning. It may sound unusual, but I haven't planned anything that I've done. And I just sort of live day by day, and I just happen to be at the right place at the right time. And when an opportunity is offered to me, I usually take advantage of me if I like it. And I went to Wright Field when I returned from the war in 1945 as a maintenance officer, and I used to put on air shows because I obviously could fly an airplane. And then my commander, Colonel Boyd, said, "Hey, you want to go to the test pilot school? You probably make a good test pilot." And I said, "Yes, sir." And I did, and I graduated, and then I was selected for the X-1 for one reason, other than I could fly an airplane, and that was I had a maintenance background and understood systems, and it was very important.
Now, you mentioned that you performed in a lot of air shows. Because of the recent air show disaster, some air shows are being canceled. Do you think air shows are safe?
Well, we've been putting on air shows ever since airplanes have been flying, and we'll keep on putting them on as long as airplanes fly. There's a matter of safety regulations and complying with those. Like the flyby line there at Ramstein Air Base was only 1,500 feet from the crowd. That's complying with the Federal Republic of Germany's regulations. And here, if you look at the air shows that go in the United States, you'll see a flyby line out some 5,000 feet. You'll also see some regulations that prohibit airplanes flying at the crowd. And you can control air shows and make them safe. That's the way you do anything. I don't think you should stop doing anything when you have an accident. If we have a commercial airline accident, we don't stop flying a commercial airplane. So,
what kind of flying do you do now?
I am fortunate in that I retired in 1975, but the Air Force, in order to not lose my many years of experience, and I'm still exceptionally healthy, I have a consultant test pilot's job at Edwards Air Force Base, and I fly 15s, F-16s. I get in an F-18 occasionally, F-4s quite a bit, T-38s, and I've flown AV-8B Harrier aircraft.
Since you don't get the adrenaline rush, which I'm sure you always used to get from testing out new planes, do you have another hobby or profession that gives you that same kind of exciting charge?
Well, yeah, I still get a charge out of flying new airplanes because, as I mentioned before, new technology that we're working on. And one thing that we've learned, like Bud Anderson and I, who was in World War II together, and we live about 25 miles, we do a lot of hunting and fishing and backpacking in the high Sierras, and we sort of challenge ourselves. We're interested in longevity, so we started backpacking in the high Sierras at high altitude, between 12 and 14,000 feet, and living off golden trout. And, we may set ourselves a distance of some 15, 18 miles to go in one day. Well, why? Because it's a challenge, and it keeps us in good shape, and it forces us to stay in good shape the rest of the year so we won't have to work so hard before we go up in the mountains, and we hope to live a long time.
I have one quick question for you.
Yeah.
I know I've been woken up several times in the middle of the night, especially when I was a child, by sonic booms.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if that ever happened to you.
No, noises don't scare me. Yes, I suppose I'm hardened to it. And one thing, very few people hear sonic booms today because there are specified corridors for flying faster than speed of sound in, and you don't hear them too often. So.
No wonder I only remember it from childhood.
That's right.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry.
My guest has been General Chuck Yeager, whose new book is titled Press On, Further Adventures in the Good Life. It's published by Bantam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with journalist Mark Hertzgard. His new book is a critical analysis of how the press has covered the Reagan presidency. It's titled On Bended Knee. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the serious business of comedy with comedian Carol Leifer. Though she's a regular on Late Night with David Letterman, she says she still gets her share of audiences who dare her to make them laugh. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the career of singer and pioneer disc jockey Rufus Thomas. He's best remembered for his dance songs like The Funky Chicken and The Dog. And book critic John Leonard has a review of Joseph Heller's new novel, Picture This. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. Hurricane Gilbert is heading for the Gulf of Mexico, packing 160-mile-an-hour winds. The hurricane, upgraded by forecasters to a Category 5 storm, today battered the Cayman Islands after leaving a trail of devastation through Jamaica. Oil companies are evacuating their workers from the Gulf as Gilbert heads in their direction at speeds of up to 15 miles an hour. Only two Category 5 storms have struck land in this century. The last, Hurricane Camille, killed 256 people when it hit Louisiana and Mississippi. While firefighters in Yellowstone get a break from blazes there, the emphasis shifts west to California and Oregon. A fire in the Sierra Nevada in California has destroyed nearly 100 homes and forced the evacuation of 8,000 residents. A fire in Oregon is causing concern as it burns through a stand of giant old-growth trees. Alan Saporin of member station KLCC in Eugene has more.
There are some common denominators for the fires burning throughout the West. The land is bone dry from months of drought, and the already troublesome fires have been turned into monstrous blazes by fierce winds. Now, however, all the new fires, like this blaze just outside Oak Ridge, Oregon, have an additional problem. Forest Service Officer Chuck Tan says there's a severe personnel shortage.
We're having trouble getting crews like most fires are because, you know, resources are very, very thin across the U.S. With all the fires in Montana and Wyoming. This, of course, is a very important fire because of the resource value. Burning an old-growth timber.
The old growth is a concern partly because of its high dollar value, but also because once it starts burning, it will burn hotter than anything else in the forest, and that means the fire will be all the more difficult to put out. For National Public Radio, this is Alan Saporin reporting.
Michael Dukakis is concentrating on national security issues during his latest campaign swing. In Chicago today, he discussed U.S.-Soviet relations before heading to Michigan. NPR's Linda Wertheimer reports.
Governor Michael Dukakis told a mostly friendly crowd at a defense plant in Michigan that he would make the improvement of America's conventional forces a top priority in his administration.
We need a new president who will invest our defense dollars in the fiber and the muscle of our national defense. We need a new president who will give us a dollar's worth of security for a dollar spent.
Dukakis spoke at the General Dynamics facility in Sterling Heights, Michigan, where the M1 tank, an important component of this country's conventional arsenal, was designed. Taking out a tank for a test drive, Dukakis circled a field, then charged toward a crowd of television cameras gathered to record the event, swinging the tank around at the last minute, grinning as the barrel of its 120-millimeter gun passed over reporters' heads. Tomorrow, Dukakis plans a major speech on defense. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Michigan.
Pope John Paul II said Mass in Botswana today, calling the country an island of peace amid southern Africa's troubles. Botswana's borders were opened for the day to allow Catholics from white-ruled South Africa to attend a papal Mass. The Botswana's president called on the pontiff to help end apartheid, while the Pope praised Botswana's concern for refugees fleeing from racial segregation. While not on the Pope's itinerary, South Africa has officially applauded Pope John Paul's rejection of violence, sanctions, and election boycotts as political weapons against apartheid. Freed hostage Rudolf Kortus returned to his native West Germany late today after 20 months of captivity in Lebanon. The West German businessman was freed yesterday by his pro-Iranian kidnappers. He was turned over to West German authorities in Damascus, where he was reunited with his wife. Kortus told reporters, "It's as if I've been granted a new life." Kortus was the last West German held hostage in Lebanon, where 17 foreigners, including 9 Americans, are still missing. Stock prices rose on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 10 points to close at 2083.04. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rufus Thomas brought the golden era of black vaudeville to the rock and roll stage and taught many young singers how to move, including a tall and gawky Otis Redding. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of Thomas, a singer who reputedly knows over 100 dances.
Shucks. It's all right.
James Brown is the godfather of soul, then Rufus Thomas must be the grandfather of soul. He was born 71 and a half years ago, and his career has taken him from Ma Rainey in the 1920s to a tour of Japan this spring, so I say that with all due respect. Elvis Presley and Otis Redding notwithstanding, if anybody put Memphis on the musical map, it was Rufus Thomas. He was born in 1917 in Collierville, Tennessee, but his family soon moved to Memphis, where young Rufus made his debut on stage at the age of 14. Before long, he'd hooked up with Ma Rainey's Rabbit Foot Minstrels, where a motherly blues singer named Georgia Dixon took him under her wing and taught him stage presence and how to dance. Both of these came in handy later. By the end of World War II, Rufus was married and had a daughter, and in order to support his family, he became one of the first disc jockeys on WDIA in Memphis, a powerful station known as the Mother Station of the Negroes because it broadcast black music all over the South. He was also making obscure blues records, and on weekends, he emceed the amateur night show at the Palace and Handy Theaters, where first prize was a dollar. There, he discovered a guitar player named Riley King, who would walk into town with his guitar and a gunny sack to play because he needed that dollar so badly. Rufus finally got him a job on the radio, where, as the Beale Street Blues Boy, he became known as B.B. King. In 1953, Rufus had played Willie Mae Thornton's record Hound Dog so many times that he decided he could do that, too. So he found a little studio in Memphis and jumped into big-time record-making with both feet. Bearcat, his answer to Hound Dog, got the label sued for plagiarism, but it put Sun Records on the map, so Rufus made another record for them that drove people wild. From then on, Rufus was a huge celebrity in Memphis, but he had no intention of becoming a rock and roll star. He liked doing what he did, having people whisper about him because he was the first black DJ to play Elvis on the radio, and being the goofy MC at the amateur shows. In fact, he didn't make another record until 1960 when his 18-year-old daughter Carla begged him to get her a record deal, and they cut a duet for another young label, Stax, called 'Cause I Love You. Stax was so happy that they told him the door was open anytime he wanted to record. And when Carla came home from school one day with a new dance, he walked over to Stax and cut his next hit.
Come on, babe. Do the dog. Do the dog. Do the dog. Do the dog.
The song wasn't much, but the dance was hot, so he figured another dog song couldn't hurt and came up with this. The one problem with the dog was that it was such a dirty dance you couldn't do it on Bandstand, But they didn't know that in Britain, where the song became a must-do for a generation of bands coming up. Stax, counting their money, decided that Rufus had the inside track on teenage dance crazes. He wasn't about to disappoint them, even if he had to invent them himself. Some of those dances Georgia Dixon had taught him came in handy as he recorded Can Your Monkey Do the Dog, The Chicken Scratch, The Sophisticated Sissy, and this masterpiece.
Something I want to show you. Now y'all heard of the popcorn, y'all heard of the dog, and you heard about all of them other dances. But now that's a brand new dance that's going around. I want to show you exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the funky chicken.
Even Joan Baez did the funky chicken. There were more. The push and pull, the breakdown, the funky penguin. Rufus churned out dance hits until Stax Records went broke in the mid-70s. And he's ready to do some more. What I need right now, he told a friend of mine recently, is another dog.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. When Carol Leifer was writing for Saturday Night Live, she saw her best material performed by others. That was during the 1985-86 television season, and Leifer has been working at her own stand-up act ever since. She's a frequent guest on Late Night with David Letterman, and Letterman was the executive producer on Leifer's first Cinemax comedy special. Much of Leifer's humor comes from her own experiences, such as growing up in suburbia and being a woman in her 30s living alone in New York.
So I'm divorced, so what else can I tell you about myself? I don't have any kids. Well, at least none that I know about. I'd like to have kids one day, though. I want to be called mommy by someone other than Spanish guys in the street. Singles bars? Forget about it. Go in these places, guys in there introduce themselves by their sign. Hi, Jim Steadman, cancer. Hi, Carol Leifer, bladder infection.
You're very funny about being divorced and single. I guess I don't know if you're still single, but if you are, is the single life what you thought it would be like after you got your divorce?
Actually, no. I thought once I got divorced, pretty much single life would be very much like That Girl, that kind of thing, you know, get way overdressed and fly a kite kind of motif. But no, I was really sadly surprised to see that it was pretty, it's pretty grim out there, pretty bleak. But that is the good thing about doing stand-up comedy is you can vent a lot of that frustration on stage.
Do you have a worst-case scenario in your mind about being single?
Let's see. Well, there's something I did. I did a Cinemax special this year, Carol Doesn't Leifer Anymore. And I did this thing where I kind of fantasized about what it would be like you know, if I'd never meet anybody again, if I, you know, never got married again. And it was kind of myself, you know, with like a really thick blue eyeshadow and, you know, the lipstick on your teeth kind of woman. And I'm at a video dating center, and I have, and I'm making a videotape of myself, and I'm like, hello, my name is Carol. I'm 50. I enjoy good food, long walks in the rain, and I'm looking for someone I can share and care with. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, if I ever do a video dating videotape like that, I mean, someone please.
Tell me about your background. What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
Well, I grew up in a pretty, very middle class neighborhood in Long Island. Long Island, how would I describe it? Well, if you're from out of town, I grew up with the kind of girls you always hear complaining real loud in restaurants, always saying to their boyfriends stuff like, Michael, like, listen to me, Michael. Michael, taste my tab. I think it's a Coke.
Before you realized that you would grow up and become a comic, what were your alternate plans? What did you think you'd be?
Boy, that's a really good question, because, knock on wood, this has worked out so far, because I have no other skills for anything. I mean, I even talk in my act about how, you know, even when I had a regular job, I was one of those people who couldn't even call in sick right, you know? I was one of those people like, hello, no, I can't come in today, I have scurvy. You know, I don't really know what I would be doing if I wasn't doing this.
Do you think of any of the material in your performances as being mostly for the women in the audience?
I do this thing about going shopping in Bloomingdale's, you know, ritzy, fancy store, and walking in and feeling like all the other women are looking at me like, is Penny's closed? So something like that, you know, men laugh at too, but I think you've really got to be a woman to really appreciate what that feels like.
What's your typical working day like?
If you can call it that, working day. I get up. I have a little coffee, a little oat bran muffin, because, you know, that's very good. It lowers the cholesterol, oat bran. And, see, the thing I like best about being a comedian is you can, in a lot of ways, be a total goof, which I'm very used to being, you know, watching things like Love Connection, which is one of my favorite shows. Watching Jeopardy, you know, I enjoy these things. I pick up the Times. Go to the gym, do a little exercising.
Well, you know, I think Adam made women in the old days, pioneer women, you know? They didn't have to go to spas. I mean, women in the 1880s weren't like, you know, Marge, I find that hoeing is so good for the upper arm. Really. You know, the other day, I'm plowing. Right, so the oxen broke free. Dragged me through the mud on my face. No, but I'll tell you, the next day my skin had such a glow.
You're not a very guilty person, huh? I mean, I think it's hard for a person who has a lot of guilt to maintain that kind of schedule and convince themselves that they're really actually working.
Well, you know what it is? I think when you have, there are certain nights you have as a stand-up comedian that are so, so horrible. I mean, I don't think most people realize that. It doesn't matter how far along the ladder you are. You always have bad nights where, you know, the audience, it's just not going to happen. Or hecklers, or the sound system goes out, or something terrible. And there's certain nights like that that I always think, well, you see, this is why I can watch Love Connection every day, because it balances out with these other horrible nights that you have, or, you know, traveling or that kind of thing. So I don't feel guilty about it at all. I really and I don't write that way either, you know, this sitting down kind of disciplined thing. I wish I could say that I was so good that way, but, you know.
How do you write?
I just, if something seems funny to me, I'll just write it down in the moment. If I think, A lot of it comes from doing different things. Like the time I was on Letterman, I did a lot of stuff about going on a cruise.
Mm-hmm.
But the nice thing about a cruise is it's relaxing and the food is great and there's all you can...
But I'll tell you one thing, though. One night, I was invited to sit at the officer's table. I was real excited. You know, this is the part where I get to meet, like, Gavin McLeod, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Oh, these officers, what a surly bunch.
Really?
Ooh, all sitting there with that gee I never get to steer look on their face.
Have you ever met someone with absolutely no sense of humor?
Unfortunately, yes. And unfortunately, they were in my audience at the time. Uh-oh. Yeah, they're occasionally, but I think that's a great thing about doing stand-up comedy, too. I mean, it's all a goof, you know? It's really all about having fun. So sometimes you'll see people who just look so... you know, I have my own business. I'm a corporate chairman of whatever, and it's a little too much for me to start guffawing here. But then you see them halfway through the show, and they're just having a great time. I mean, you know, a lot of people, I think, feel defensive about, you know, you get those people in the audience that are like, that make me laugh kind of thing. But after a while, I mean, people just let go and have fun.
Okay. Carol, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Carol Liefer is appearing this week at Caroline's at the Seaport in New York. Here's a scene from her Cinemax comedy special, Carol Doesn't Liefer Anymore.
Okay, I'm divorced, but I don't want to hear another thing about being divorced. I'm going to meet somebody great. And you know, I'm not afraid of what I want. I want a guy who'll give me the world.
This is All News All the Time. You give us 22 minutes, we'll give you the world.
What's your name?
And now the news. A 32-year-old divorced woman went on a shooting spree today in Long Branch, New Jersey, screaming, "I can't take it anymore." No one was hurt. In other headlines.
Good evening, this is Larry King from Washington. Tonight's topic, the pain and trauma of divorce. Our special guests will...
Center fielder Roy Willis takes a called strike three. Caught the boy looking. And I guess it's kind of hard to concentrate, fans, when you're going through a divorce.
This is Fresh Air. Let's look ahead to All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, we're talking a lot about the weather today. We have a report about Hurricane Gilbert and also about the snows which came to Yellowstone Park over the weekend and perhaps signal the end to the terrible wave of forest fires there. We also speak with a man who's gathering stories about snow and the first encounters people have had with snow and a history of snow in New England. It's an author's query that was in the papers over the weekend. And we have reports from the presidential campaigns, Linda Wertheimer, Jim Angle covering the Dukakis and Bush campaigns as they are busily talking up defense and other things.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Joseph Heller has a new novel that unites several of Western civilization's cultural figures and weaves back and forth in time, ours and theirs. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Picture This.
There's no reason Joe Heller couldn't have made an interesting novel out of the materials of Picture This. But the author of such time bombs and alarm clocks as Catch 22, Something Happened, and Good as Gold has instead made a mess. Let's suppose that when Rembrandt is painting Aristotle contemplating the bust of Homer, what Aristotle is really thinking about is Rembrandt. The painter seems to the philosopher neither an interesting person nor a nice one, although he has a way with light and shadow and somber tones. Aristotle doesn't like Amsterdam either in the 17th century. It's not much of an improvement on the common and commercial Athens he remembers from the 4th century BC. Nor will he enjoy 20th century New York when he hangs in the Metropolitan Museum of Art with a very high price on his head. All those centuries gone by and still nobody's reading his essay on ethics. Whereas Rembrandt thinks about nothing but money. He carries a heavy mortgage. One of his mistresses demands palimony. He is sold his dead wife's grave. His competitor Flink is paid more for a Rembrandt imitation than Rembrandt is paid for an original. Maybe, in fact, the painting we look at in the Met is an imitation instead of an original. Certainly the bust that Aristotle contemplates isn't really Homer, nor, of course, is the man in the picture really Aristotle. Is money the only art? This flim-flam might have worked. If not as a novel, then maybe as a meditation on the counterfeiting of money and art and history, or a monograph on fetishism and surplus value in Western culture. But Heller has looked into a cracker barrel instead of the abyss. He's a bully and a crank. He interrupts Rembrandt and Aristotle to push and shove the reader. If I.F. Stone in his recent polemic, The Trial of Socrates, was hard on Socrates and soft on Athens, Heller is contemptuous of Athens and downright sycophantic about Socrates. Athens, he says, was an anthill of demagogic and reactionary warmongers, bought oracles, inside traders, slaves, and many little Vietnams. Amsterdam in the money-grubbing golden age was even worse. In his last novel, God Knows, Heller trashed the Old Testament as a sort of Blazing Saddles Western. In Picture This, he tells us that all of history is greed and violence, and all of art is lying about it. Democracy is fraudulent, and man is vile, and who cares? How odd that the author of Good as Gold, a vivisection of American neoconservatives, should sound here so much like a neoconservative himself. One of those tenured ducks, those Henry R. Luce professors of I'm All Right, Jack, for whom original sin is an excuse for their own shameless enjoyment of power and privilege. Heller does get off some good lines. An endearing feature of Greek wars then, he says, was that people advocating them often died in them. And England was a monarchy and could create an empire. The Dutch were a republic and created only dealerships. And yet, Rembrandt painted pictures that were prettier than Rembrandt, and Athens had ideas that were better than Athens's behavior. And the mystery of this transcendence is what a good book could have been written about.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed Joseph Heller's new novel, Picture This. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we continue our series of interviews with Fresh Air contributors, and we hear from our book critic, John Leonard. For as long as he can remember, he's never left his house without a book in his pocket. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording of 13th-century Spanish choral works performed by Alcatraz, a San Francisco ensemble. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses the difficulty novelists face in writing naturalistic dialogue. He thinks novelist Don DeLillo has succeeded in his new work, Libra. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome two stations new to Fresh Air, WMFE in Orlando, Florida, and KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.